My name is Leslie Harris. I'm the president of the Center for Democracy and Technology here in Washington. The panel is labeled sort of what should Congress do about health information technology. I think we're going to probably focus a lot on the privacy questions. I think that at least in the public's mind, at least since the Institute of Medicine's first published Crossing the Quality Chasm about, what, 8 years ago? I think there's been a growing consensus that health information technology can be a critical tool for improving healthcare, reducing errors, and empowering consumers. And there's obviously been an increased federal commitment and a vision about building a national interconnected health network. Things are moving along outside of Washington. States and regions and hospitals are building networks and regional data exchanges. Companies like Microsoft are beginning to build online personal health care records, PHRs, for people to store and manage their own health care. But very little consensus or progress has been made in resolving the privacy issues that come along with increased liquidity of health data. There are many fairly sponsored panels and agencies and groups and alphabet soup, of which I am only learning, that have different pieces of this. Congress has had a couple of brush fires recently in the context of the Wired bill around what to do about privacy. And I think what we're going to talk about with this panel today is twofold. I don't think that you can really look at the question of what's the right answer to privacy unless you have a solid view of what it is you're trying to achieve. The answer to privacy is different if you're trying to prevent an inherent evil as compared to try to facilitate a good. And so I think it's important for us to set a baseline and also see whether all our panelists are more or less on the same page of that. I think that there is a growing view that not resolving privacy, and that does not necessarily mean by a single law passed by Congress, but not reaching some kind of understanding about how privacy is being protected in what are now a lot of different places. Some more and more people are touching data even inside the healthcare system, but not getting that resolved is in and of itself a barrier to real robust HIT adoption. And I think the polls continue to show that a significant number of consumers, but certainly those who are among the most privacy protected, will shy away from the advantages of some of these tools unless we can come up with a better statement about how privacy is being protected, whether that is through policy, standards, best practices, and my guess is a combination of all of those. So we're going to ask our panelists today to sort out that conundrum in HIT, and also to answer the question, what role, if any, does Congress and the administration have in setting a privacy floor? I'm going to briefly introduce our panelists. We only have three, so I think I will ask them to make brief opening remarks. I didn't mean that. But very, very right. Now Peter's put his remarks away, and now we've got to take them back out. So with us today, next to me, is Peter Neubert. He is currently the corporate vice president of Microsoft's Health Solutions Group, which develops innovations and solutions to meet business and clinical requirements healthcare, and also to empower consumers to take a more active role in their healthcare management. Before joining, is rejoining Microsoft, he led drugstore.com and served on President Bush's Information Technology Advisory Committee. Legia Riccardi is principal in Clear Voice Consulting, which is a practice focused on healthcare information technology from a consumer perspective. She spent 6 years at the Markle Foundation and was involved in their very important Connecting for Health collaborative project. She was the director of the health programs. She is now consulting with a lot of groups, and I suppose for purposes of some kind of disclosure, including my own. John Halamka is a physician, chief information officer of, we need a chart, folks, Harvard Medical School, the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, I'm not going to do them all, also chairs the New England Health Data Interchange, as well as HISBI, which is the Federal Health Informatics Standards Panel. And we're going to talk a little bit about how standards plays into this. I'm hoping Deborah Peel, who's a very well-known privacy advocate in this space, will join us. I think it'll make the information and the conversation more interesting and lively if she does. But let me start by giving each of you just a minute to say, you know, why you're in this space, why it's important, what you're doing, but really briefly. Because I'm gonna get these folks into the conversation very early.
We're gonna leave time for questions, right?
We're gonna leave lots of time.
So why are we in this space? So this is a really take a very complicated topic like health, add some charged words like privacy and information technology, and condense it down into two sentences. Good challenge. Fundamentally, the delivery of health is an information management problem. The advances over the last 10 years have largely been the result of great software, a little bit with physics, some better understanding of what goes on. And if you think about the challenges of our generations over the next 20 years, it's really about how do you deliver better tools to researchers, to clinicians, and hopefully to consumers so that they can get better results, whether it's better results in decision support in the clinical side or whether it's better results in terms of consumers interacting with their health information. So Microsoft is in the context of being the world's largest software company, think we have something to contribute. Hurry up, Deborah, then I can slow down. We think we have something to contribute to how people think about these very complicated information management systems and tools. And that's why we're in the business. I think why I'm on the panel is we introduced a product in October called Health Vault, which is all about how do we enable consumers to connect, collect, gather, store, and manage their information. It's an open ecosystem. And in order for us to think about how does our brand extend to being a custodian of people's private health information, we really had to think through the privacy issues, the security issues, the trust issues, and how what were the means by which we could be an effective custodian to do that. And I think it comes down to some very straightforward principles, which is the consumer's in control. And in that regard, that's our approach, and I'm happy to go in more depth later.
Okay. I personally am in this space because I believe that technology and information technology is one of the most important factors that's really shaping society at this point in time, and I think it has immense potential for powerful impact potentially for social good. And I think that's true in a number of areas, including health. We've all heard talk about how in the health sphere, information technology can improve access and quality and cut down costs and benefit public health and research. It's got numerous potential benefits, but none of these is a given, and that's really important. Technology ultimately is just a set of tools, and what really matters is how we use them, how we implement them. And that's the space that I'm interested in working in, and making sure that tools are set up and developed in ways that benefit consumers. And that's really that's what I work on.
John, and then Deborah, I'm going to have to I'll introduce you and let you do your spiel at the same time.
I spent my life connecting patients, providers, and payers. And that really takes four forms. The first, of course, is that we need to have the standards, because you can't connect a database with patient information in it from a doctor to a patient unless there's some standard way of transmitting that information securely. It takes an architecture. And, of course, we leverage the web, and we use all the tools like you've built to make patients stewards of their own data. And, unfortunately, for this country, there isn't a unifying architecture that allows us to, so to speak, take trains from New York to Los Angeles. There's regional health efforts, there's a lot of local health efforts, but there's lack of coordination. Maybe the kind of work that you're doing and other vendors are doing will help the patients now have a national ecosystem. But certainly that will need a national architecture, at least standards and architecture working together. Privacy is a big issue, and in Massachusetts, we'll certainly talk a lot about this. Opt-in consent is typically what we do, it's very patient-centric. Figuring out the consent models, how you ensure privacy is protected throughout the sharing of data is quite important. and then fostering adoption. Turns out that when you really look at how many doctors in this country use electronic health records that are robust, and I mean e-prescribing, decision support, clinical charting, and problem lists, it's about 4%. So sure, 18% have an electronic health record, but really use about 4%. So how do we, in our region, get it up to, say it's about 40%, get it up to 100%, a lot on that team. This ecosystem's only as good as there is electronic data to exchange.
Well, so Deborah, I'm going to introduce you. We're going to do this all in one.
Okay.
So Deborah Peel is a physician, and she's the founder of the Patient Privacy Rights. It's a national consumer advocacy organization working to, you say, restore the right to health privacy, so we'll have an interesting conversation about that. And in 2008, I understand PPR intends to launch Privacy Rights Certified to certify electronic systems and software that meet privacy standards, and that'll be an interesting conversation as well. Deborah, I hate to just sort of throw you right in, but can you give a few opening remarks?
Sure, I apologize for being late. Thank you for the chance to be on the panel and to talk with everyone. First of all, I founded Patient Privacy Rights because we have no control over our electronic health data right now. That's the State of the Union. And I brought handouts. If we have not visited your office, this particular handout shows the single sentence in the amended privacy rule that eliminated every individual's control over personal health information. It says, the consent provisions are replaced with a new provision that provides regulatory permission for covered entities, there's over 4 million of them, to use and disclose protective health information, that's your data, for treatment, payment, and healthcare operations. What that means is someone else gets to decide if they can use your health information. That is a massive, massive shift in the way things have been in this country forever. I also have this little diagram for you all, if you would like it. This shows all of the different kinds of entities today that can legally use and exchange your health information without your knowledge over your objections retroactively today because of that change in HIPAA. So anyway, if you want to graphically see what we're talking about, that's it. We have to start there. This past summer, CIO Magazine did a story on a group of industry were concerned about the safety of electronic medical record systems. They tested 850 systems. Every one of them could be penetrated. So not only do we not have control over who can see and use our most sensitive information, it's not secure either. So that's the reason that many of the technology companies that really want to do what's right, want to adhere to the law and medical ethics and build systems that can deliver all the benefits we want from health IT, but strengthen and support patient rights, have come to us and said, you know, please do something. We have smart technology, and that's the good news. There's smart technology that can deliver the kind of results we want, get the kind of benefits we want from research and so on, if we use it with patients in control. So we're saying, let's use smart technology, and we need you all to help your bosses write smart laws that reinforce our rights. And then we can have all the information instantly where we want it, when we need it, but it won't go to data miners. Just one example about data mining. Probably the major use of all electronic health information has nothing to do with taking care of sick people. It's very, very valuable information. In 2006, we got a poster child for data theft, IMS Health. Their entire business is selling prescription records. In 2006, they reported revenues of $1.75 billion. That was 2005. 2006, it was $2 billion. So we have one data miner, one data mining entity profiting from Americans' health records at the same time that we can't afford to deliver care. This doesn't make sense.
I'm going to bring it back to the whole conversation, but let me ask a couple of questions.
Sure.
Just throw a couple of questions out based on sort of some of your assumptions.
Sure.
I want to hear what the rest of the panel has to say. There's no doubt that the legal requirement of consent is not part of HIPAA anymore. It's less clear to me that it somehow has been withdrawn either as a matter of medical ethics or in terms of the policies and laws at the state and other levels. So, Lydia, do you want to start with that?
Well, I just wanted to jump in.
And then I want to get to the question of whether consent is the answer.
Well, that was actually what I really wanted to
answer. All right, so we're going to skip on to is consent the answer.
So I think consent is perhaps a part of the answer, and I think it's very important in the context of health information sharing that patients be able to make choices. But I also think that putting too great an emphasis on consent without another broader set of protections for consumers can be really dangerous. And that's in part because consent decisions are often made in a situation in which the patient is in seeing a physician, they have a health problem, they're probably feeling ill, they're scared, they're not really in the frame of mind to be able to make a complicated choice about how their health information should be used. In addition, I think really good consent, policy requires a certain level of education for consumers, which frankly is challenging to reach. I heard in one of the panels earlier today that folks are spending hundreds of millions of dollars trying to talk the public through the switch to HDTV, and that still they're not getting the message. I'm concerned that getting everybody up to speed when you have varying levels of education across the country, 100 or more different languages spoken, is going to be incredibly challenging. Again, that's not to say that consent isn't a piece of a broader privacy-protecting framework, but it is just one piece, and it's essential that we have a strong base of other protections in place as well.
Do other panelists want to contribute to that? Sure.
And so our practice has been at the hospital level, there is a general consent sign to describe the fact that within our four walls, we will be using data among caregivers for the benefit of the patient. And in the course of the last 10 years where I've been the CIO at Federal Bureau of Legal Defense, there's only been two individuals who did not want that to happen. Now, of course, the challenge is that if we can't use electronic records, we can't be prescribed, we can't deliver safe care, so we tell them, there's this great hospital called the Brigham and Women's, they're right across the street, maybe you'd actually like to go there, but we actually have to use an electronic record to deliver quality care. We haven't sold data mines, we keep it very controlled and constrained, and the only time we will share is when there is the opt-in consent. But the combination of policy and security protections for us has worked pretty well.
Peter, do you want to talk about consent in the context of health thought? You move onto the internet, you move out of the world of HIPAA protection. Certainly, consent becomes perhaps more important, but it also becomes more, it's more complex.
I'm not sure it becomes more complex, but I think I want to reframe it just a little bit, because I think John started to bring us back, and I wanted to come back there. And, you know, when I think about the challenges that we face in this country, we spend $2+ trillion in healthcare. Nobody, I really think, we're getting good value for that $2+ trillion. And we ought to think about what can we do to get better outcomes. And I think information technology, and as you said, 4% are using electronic, the robustness of electronic medical records. And that, you know, bad things happen to people all the time because the right information isn't available at the right time. And the solution to that, unfortunately, is inevitably making it electronic and taking it from paper. Now, privacy is super important, but as I think you were inferring, though you didn't go quite and say it, is would I rather go to a place where I had some risk of loss about privacy, or would I rather go to a hospital where I had a high degree of confidence, hospital, medical delivery system, whatever it was, that I was going to get the right drug at the right time, or the right diagnosis at the right time? And I'll bet if you pose that question to 100 different consumers, 99%, yours was 99.999 if I did the math, would choose, I'll take the slight risk of privacy exposure to get the better quality of care. And I think that's an important context to keep, because there's no, you know, I've been doing software for 30 years, he's probably been doing it for as long and better, but there's no simple, perfect, make it right every time solution. So there's always some trade-offs in these architectures. So with regard to pitching Health Vault's really about recognizing that there's a world that has to live within some constraints around HIPAA, in a world that I believe the consumer can control, because, you know, the stuff I keep in my file folder isn't protected by HIPAA, and I choose to keep it in my file folder. What I'd like to do is be able to create a copy of the stuff that does exist in HIPAA evaluated or controlled entities and put it over into this other place called Health Vault, which is an electronic file folder that then I have complete control over. We make it very clear, just go look at our front page at www.healthvault.com, what we will and won't do with it. And that is, we won't do anything with it. You get to decide at a very granular level what it is you do and who you want to share with. I happen to think health data by itself is not very interesting, and it's particularly not very useful. It's only useful if you can turn it into some knowledge, into some actionable event. And so Health Vault is a programmable web service that makes it useful should you choose to share it, you the consumer choose to share it. And that's what we're trying to do. I think I actually learned about data liquidity from John when I was on the PTAC a long time ago, and that how important it is to get the data flowing around so good things can happen. And that's what we're trying to do with Health Vault, but in a very private, secure, let the consumer decide what level of risk and what level of thing. And if you don't want to have your data in Health Vault, don't have it. You don't have it. We're trying to do it that way.
So that kind of takes me back to the question of consent, because you can argue on the one hand that this liquidity requires, you know, much more granular consent. You can also argue if what you're trying to do is exchange data, that you know, sort of a granular level of, you know, one yes for no, for these purposes, no for those purposes, can add a level of complexity to data exchange that starts undermining the purpose you're doing this. So
can I just jump in?
Yeah, and then I'm going to let Deborah, and then people in the audience already want to talk. So.
Well, that's great. But yeah. But one point I'd like to just, and maybe it's because I'm old these days, but we have to think of what evolution we have to go through. And that what we're really trying to do, and as I think John pointed out, is we need to get to a spot where it's easy to connect and talk through some set of standards or architecture or some combination thereof, and policies and how we implement those policies will determine the rate at which we get those connections to happen. Once we get those connections to happen, a lot of other stuff happens. Then we can imagine a world where we can do things differently. But we have to imagine what are the steps we have to take to get to that world so we can imagine the future world even better. And that's sort of where I think Health Vault is well positioned, because it's a step we can take that will, if done well, along with other efforts, create some standards that create connectivity to happen a lot faster. So that's the, I always encourage people to think not where I want to be 10 years from now, but what are the steps I have to get along the way to get to that 10 years from
now.
Yeah, Yeah,
I'd
just like to talk a little bit about consent and the idea that it's too complicated. Every one of you, when you go to a doctor, you decide what to tell them and what to share with them. Everybody, no matter what level of education they have, they choose what they tell which doctor and when and why. And so if you think about the healthcare system, you've always sliced and diced who you tell what to. When you see your allergist, you don't talk to him about your pap smear. When you see your podiatrist, you don't talk about your marital therapy. It's really important to remember that patients have always chosen who gets to know what things about them. And that's always been their right. And, you know, Ligia, when you talk about stronger protections, there isn't anything stronger than consent, than the right to say, no, I don't want this information shared with this person at this time. There isn't any stronger protection. Yes, there's certainly a need for education, and there are now interactive consent management tools to help people walk through what they want to do. You can write advanced directives for emergency situations. You can delegate all of your lab, et cetera, to go to your internist, but not over here to your podiatrist. You know, the tools are there to be able to have exquisite, instantaneous, granular control down to the data field if you want, but we have to choose to use them. And the idea that we should have choices is kind of putting a gloss over this issue. This isn't really about choice. It's been our rights. It still is our rights under state laws, constitutional law, tort law, contract law, medical ethics, to control who can see and use our data. There's nothing radical about suggesting that consumers control their data. The health system, and the reason so few physicians have electronic medical records in their offices, is think about it, the electronic medical system was not designed by doctors and patients as a system of medical records. It was designed by corporations moving data for specific purposes, lab data, claims data, etc. It was never designed for control. It was never designed actually to be a system to help doctors with patients. Now that we've got this system where all this information flows to private corporations, you know, they're trying to say, well, gee, let's get it to the people that really need it, the patients and the doctors. Well, it's about time. It's about time. And electronic records can be absolutely fantastic. And there is no reason to choose between connectivity and privacy. These two things are not opposed. In fact, as a practicing physician, I've been practicing for 30 years, you know, I promise you, people don't walk in the door. They don't walk in my door. Of course, I'm a shrink. If they think the information is going to be on the internet. So yes, okay, I'm in the most privacy-sensitive specialty. That's why I know. And many of my patients say to me, for God's sake, don't tell my surgeon about this. Don't tell my husband about this. You know, and so, you know, I'm very used to patients picking and choosing, you know, who they tell what to. And, you know, and Halamka, John and his hospital, they've got opt-in and opt-out. That's real gross, but at least it's a certain amount of control.
Well, John, let me ask a question.
The tools are available, or soon will be, to do more than simply opt-in blanket, yes or no.
You've got opt-in and opt-out, but within your hospital system, among your doctors and... Are you having patients opt in and out of every transaction between your participating?
We are not.
Explain why not?
Sure. So I want to bring together your notion of highly granular consent and your notion of evolution. So when we look at our community, we look at the capacity of vendor-built systems and home-built systems to actually control data flows. You'd love to say, you know, if I'm seeing an emergency physician and I'm unconscious and it will save my life, sure, share my HIV status, psychiatric notes, and substance abuse history. At the present time, the vendor systems don't have that level of granularity. So what we have is share all data from this institution or no, don't. And so the patient opts in at an institution level, and that, you know, it's not as nice as you'd like it to be, but eventually there will be systems, whether they're PHRs or EHRs, that will allow that level of control. It's not episode-based. It's totally institution-based.
Let me ask you a question. Deborah has said there's nothing more powerful for privacy than consent, and I'm going to let other people get involved here because about what else matters in creating a privacy regime for this environment. And John Tuck, you've been involved in doing standards that have to do with privacy and security, so I think we should add those to the mix. And then, you know, I'd like to, Legia, there's an entire Markle framework to discuss. There's more here than consent, although consent is a critical element. I think we need to put that on the table as well.
So a quick comment on standards, in that Deborah is on my board in the Healthcare Information Technology Standards Panel. What we've tried to do over the last year is create a security framework that enables a vendor or payer or employer or patient or other stakeholders to enforce whatever privacy policy is local to them. And of course, you know, Deborah and I have had fun discussions about whether or not there is a national policy framework based on ethics or common law. But bottom line is, in Massachusetts, I have privacy policies that vary by what side of the Charles River you're on. And so if the framework says, oh, we're going to audit every transaction, who saw what when, and you're going to have access control, and you're going to have authentication, and you're going to have secure ways of sending data from place to place in a non-repudiable way, and whoever creates it signs it, and you know the common time, so that if there is a legal question of who looked at what when, what they did with it, you can figure that out. It's a framework that says whether your policies opt in, opt out, granular, not granular, the technology to enforce it exists. And that's what the NIST privacy and security standards do.
Do you want to talk a little bit about, because you built privacy into Health Vault, and building privacy into Health Vault, well, you do have consent. It's not just about consent.
Consent is the foundation, and then it's all these other things. And we've done it at a granular level. So we have this tricky kind of problem, which is It's not only about how do I enable the consumer to get access to the data. I want to also enable an application ecosystem, call it a PHR, call it a disease management tool, call it a weight loss tool, call it some other tool. I want to be able to enable, under my control, those other applications to have access to specific parts of my data vault, if you will. And so the trick is, how do you enable the applications and then provide some of the things that John talked about, like auditing, not just at a person view, but an application view, and security and all those kind of things. And that's what we have done. We think we, within the framework, figured out a way to enable sharing and privacy at the same time.
And I will say that the one thing that I think Health Vault has done, that I think we would hope, at least in the PHR world, which is out there in the cloud, with frankly nothing but FTC protection at this point, is really bind the partners in that to the same privacy policies as Health Vault itself. And I'm hoping that, at least in the non-HIPAA side of this, which I expect to grow, that will become an industry standard, because it's the forward transfer of data outside the HIPAA environment where this starts to get, I think, a little scary.
It's the HIPAA environment that allows the forward transfer of data. HIPAA allows the forward transfer of data. That's the problem. HIPAA is a data miner's dream. Anyone who's a covered entity or a business associate can use and disclose your records, and you have no opportunity to object to whoever they want to any business purpose.
Actually, I'm trying to be the moderator, but I know that's not true, so it's somebody else. Devin! Take it away, Devin. I don't want you to have a heart attack over there.
I'm Devin McGraw with the National Partnership for Women and Families. It is not true, Deborah, and you know that it's not true, that under HIPAA, anybody who's a covered entity can take data and use it for whatever purpose they want.
That's wrong. That's wrong. It is being used for purposes that no one ever gave consent for. Did you consent for IMS Health to sell your prescription records? No.
Why did they sell them, and under what guise? And to what extent was that actually a HIPAA violation?
That's my point. It's not a violation. They collect the data because they're an intermediary in the system, or they buy the data through switching companies or others, and they sell your data without your consent. Well, I mean, it's not easy to connect all the dots, but they are in fact selling everyone's data.
They're selling physician prescribing patterns. Okay. So it does, in fact, if you are a physician, and there have been lawsuits that unfortunately have been lost in that area, but they're not, to my knowledge, selling individually identified medical information to third parties. They are selling the prescribing records of a particular physician.
And in New Hampshire, it's slightly different. IMS Health has said that they don't sell the patient side of it. Many other data miners, in fact, do.
All of my colleagues have
had drug reps come to their offices with lists of patient names. This is well known.
But Deborah, can I?
Yeah.
I don't think we want to have a debate about HIPAA.
Okay. Right. I don't think it's a debate about HIPAA. It's a debate about the fact that HIPAA allows all of these corporations that touch our data to use it for what they determine is health operations. That's the point. They can choose what the health operations are, not us.
Well, I guess HIPAA is relevant insofar as talking about the big question, which is what should the federal role be in setting a floor for the new data sharing environment? I guess the question is do we build on HIPAA? Is HIPAA an inherently good floor to build on? Do we get rid of HIPAA? Or is the federal government, see none of the above, we should build on HIPAA, but understand that over time, this environment is going to get built at a lot of different levels. So you want to talk? Come talk.
Only if you have answers.
Right. But no, you can talk. This
is a question. I'm Hans Haney with the Discovery Institute, and I'm just wondering if each of you are confident that there are adequate safeguards in place so that consent to share health records is in fact voluntary and can't be coerced. I mean, for example, if I apply for a job, I apply for auto insurance, when I sign on the dotted line, they want access to my health records.
That's right.
That's the condition of applying. And so, could that happen?
Yes.
That can happen, but that's because employers aren't covered by HIPAA. So it's another whole conversation. Do you want to take this
right
one?
I mean, that's an excellent question, and that's an excellent point. And I think it sort of highlights, or it brings me back to this point, that there is no one single solution to the privacy problem in health information sharing. I think consent is a piece of it. HIPAA and the base that it has built needs to be expanded, but it's not enough on its own. I also think the private sector has a role to play, certainly in carefully designing technologies and platforms such as Health Vault that do take into account some of these fair information practices, these broader practices like the ones John was talking about. I also think there's room for other activities. One of the initiatives that I worked on over this past year was working with a number of leading employers who want to offer PHRs to their employees. But understandably, employees, you know, many have voiced a concern that that information could be used against them in some way. So what these members of the employers' working group on PHRs have done, and that includes, you know, Walmart and Dell and Pitney Bowes and others, they've come together and agreed to their own set of best practices, which are really drawn from, again, the same basic fair information practices to help avoid situations like this, to avoid situations in which somebody feels coerced to grant consent, for example.
Somewhat controversial point of view.
I hope
HIPAA.
So. Please.
HIPAA has been a great thing for me, and it's been a great thing in a couple of ways. First, it's built awareness of this problem throughout my institution. In fact, people are aware, oh, gee, here's a piece of paper, and it has Ted Kennedy and an alcohol level. That's probably a bad thing to have sitting in a public place. Not that we've ever had such a thing. Or I am now logging into a system, and I'm going to look up my neighbor's medical records. I bet that would be really interesting. Well, it turns out, because HIPAA said we have to have usernames and passwords and audit trails, people don't. They will be fired. With absolutely no questions asked.
And
you're
used
fired.
To be able to do that pretty easily.
Yeah, so it's built awareness. It's given me some basic tools on username and password and audit trails. And, of course, there's a whole standard side of HIPAA on administrative information that's going to be with different privacy. So on the whole, it was a start. Is it perfect? No. But it certainly has made my institution better than it was.
Have you thought about whether and how it should be extended or improved in this new environment? And I realize you build these things and manage them in the real world, not here in the wonky world. But you seem to hang out here in the wonky world a fair amount.
So the challenge that I have, and this is of course where we'll have a fun discussion, is that as I travel the country and the world, I find that communities all have different feelings about privacy. Mm-hmm. And it turns out in Indiana that somehow it has grown up around Indianapolis that sharing data is just such a good community thing that we'll just do it. And
so is there no opt-in to the Indiana data
exchange? No. And Massachusetts, on the other hand, is all opt-in, and we have significant protections around mental health data, which is what our community standard has been. So to me, what there needs to be is a framework that says, here are all the options, guys. You as a community, sets of community standards, you decide, and the technology, the EHR standards, is there to enforce it. I doubt, again, controversial statement, that we'll ever have a single national privacy policy that's very prescriptive. And a framework to probably all the questions.
Well, it's controversial, but representing an organization that's simply been trying to get an internet privacy law for the last 10 years, I actually think that's probably not wrong.
Well, and I think in that context, it's important to point out that health is just a subset. I mean, we have privacy is an issue for all types of transactions. Health has some unique concerns about what happens to my employment or what happens to my ability to get health insurance. But other than that, it's fundamentally these practices and principles that have to be put in place. I mean, some companies like us are building huge businesses based on a set of internet transactions where this issue impacts us at every level as we go along.
We have other questions and comments from the floor before I ask people one question. Oh, go ahead.
I think one of the, and this is actually, Leslie, going back to a question that you started with, which is, what other than consent in terms of privacy do we need to address? And one of the things that's occurring to me is that for a lot of individuals, the issue of consent, you can't even decide the question until you know exactly the framework, to borrow Dr. Hanamka's statement, is that you're consenting into or deciding to opt out of. In other words, what happens to my data? What is permissible? What isn't permissible? And so we're actually struggling with this on the confidentiality, privacy, and security work group. We wanted to get to the question of at least an in-out consent policy, and one of the other consumer reps raised the question. Consent to what? What are we talking about here? Is it this? Can we? Are there some places where we can agree that because of the changed environment that being electronically linked represents, HIPAA is now has gaps. Where are they? How do we fix them? Is it possible to fix them at a federal level, or better to create a framework within which there can be some community variation? And I'm definitely there with you on that, because certainly in my experience, I've seen RIOs addressing this in many different ways, and the community norms are driving how they come out on these questions, these trade-offs that we know that we have to make. So in terms of what role that Congress might provide, it
that
is sort of
my next question.
Right, laying the groundwork for those conversations to take place, putting money into the exploration of where we might need to fix gaps in the only federal privacy law we have, which we should all remember is right now, thankfully, a floor, because we also have stronger state laws that apply as well.
So I was about to sort of ask that question in our closing time that we have, which is, if you had to give advice to, I'm going to say the next president and the next administration, because that's when I expect things to actually start happening again. Healthcare, I think, will be on the table. We will have, I think, an opportunity, to the extent we believe that there is a role here, for all of the work, whether it's what AHEC's been thinking about or in the standards space, for something to happen. What is the thing that should happen in Congress? Do we know enough? Do we need hearings? Are there things we should be doing now? There's a lot of pressure for Congress to do something. I tend to share the view that we haven't made progress yet on privacy, and even HIPAA wound up being a regulation because we could never directly enact the privacy law. What would you, we need to get ready for a window of opportunity. What should we do? Who wants to start?
Good. Okay, so there are some things that we can go ahead and do right away, I think, but there are other things that will require a longer period of information gathering and creating a public record. I think one of the key problems with HIPAA is that it doesn't extend to many of the entities that now have access to health information electronically. And that's a big issue, and one that we can't sort of fix immediately, and that's going to require sort of long-term public debate. But we might want to think about whether protection should extend to RIOs, to PHRs, to employers, to schools. There's a whole list of possible entities that have access to information that aren't currently covered. In addition, and this is sort of a smaller fix, I think there's a great deal of public confusion, as demonstrated even here today, about what HIPAA covers and doesn't cover. So I think we need some real clarity, possibly
feel free to read.
Yeah, coming out of the Department of Health and Human Services or elsewhere, that helps people just make sense of it. Not to mention make sense of those HIPAA notices that we get as patients and most of us don't understand.
Which is why I wonder if we put the last line saying consent.
Right.
What we're giving people.
Yeah, which is what I was trying to say. There are also problems certainly with HIPAA enforcement, and that needs to be strengthened drastically. There have been no civil suits. There isn't adequate reporting on HIPAA offenses. HIPAA enforcement needs to be strengthened. And there are a couple of other things, too. For instance, HIPAA requires that people have a right of access to their information right now, but that doesn't specifically say that that access must be electronic where available. And if we could tweak that somehow, I think that would be a great boon to help information sharing generally. There are also probably some limitations on marketing that should be placed and thought about. But again, some of these are relatively quick regulatory fixes, and some of these are much longer term, should require a greater and more in-depth public process and conversation.
Maybe Jonathan wants to
Happy to jump in. So as a person who's run the Health Information Exchange for Massachusetts, I can tell you a lot of health information exchange is a public good, and no one will pay for a public good. So this is the challenge. A couple of years ago, working with the Marple Foundation, we did a number of pilots that said, in the interest of continuity of care, let's actually share everything with everybody, with appropriate protections, of course, and we'll build master patient indexes and ways in which we can thoughtfully, with patient consent, of course, share the data. Well, we would be able to take 15% of the cost of healthcare out of Massachusetts by doing that. So here's the discussion. You're the CEO of the largest hospital. So I need you to write me $1 million check so I can reduce your revenue by 15%. Sound good? Okay. Doesn't really fly. Yes. And so what we've had, unfortunately, instead, is the Health Information Exchange has looked at the local business needs, which have to be e-prescribing, because that actually reduces costs for a lot of the stakeholders, and clinical document exchange between providers. You get discharged from an emergency department, we'll push a summary of that to your provider. Same thing with the hospital. So it's a bit like if you didn't have the national highway system, you just had every local operator had their own toll road. And yeah, you could probably eventually get from New York to Los Angeles, but boy, would it be circuitous and inefficient. That's what's really happening locally. You're building health information exchanges to fit local markets because no one's paying for a public good. So if there could be alignment of incentives, if Congress could get involved so that we actually build these things, it will allow transactions with appropriate patient controls. It would be a much better healthcare ecosystem.
So what you're saying is, let's get this thing built. Peter?
So, I, as somebody who has been a key participant in the evolution of the web over the last 13 years, I guess, I look at it from a slightly different perspective. On the one hand, I think there are real issues, as Deborah's outlined and as John has outlined, in terms of inside the enterprise, how do I deal with the moving of data, what we call today inside the HIPAA bubble. When I think of how we've tried to design Health Vault, which is to enable a consumer to request a copy of their data from whatever data source that is, provider, pharmacy, lab, physician, weight loss clinic, you name it, that once it's outside that HIPAA bubble and I have control over it, I think consumers, we don't know enough yet to know what it is they're going to want to do with it and how they're going to feel about it. Because I know I feel a lot differently about my height and weight than I do about what drugs I'm on, than I might care about my cholesterol level and all kinds of other things. And that consumers surprise us a lot. They're very smart. You know, who would have imagined that we'd have eBay, where you have hundreds of sellers, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of sellers and buyers. When I started drugstore.com in 1998, we said, you're not going to get any 70-year-olds to give you your credit card. I said, if I save them $300 a month, they're going to give me their credit card. I got a lot of credit cards. And I had to earn their trust every day. We never have lost a credit card. Neither has Amazon. And so this is about the value exchange. And so if we have these sort of airy-fairy conversations about, oh, the data, and not in the context towards what end and what am I going to get out of it and what risk I'm going to take, there's no risk-free approach here. There's no risk-free approach. There's some trade-off. And so I think we have to think about as much, and I think John said it better than I could, aligning incentives. We have to keep the prize in mind of what we can do to deliver value both to consumers, which is why we've done Health Vault outside of the HIPAA context, and also to our system inside the HIPAA bubble, in terms of being able to deliver better care, better quality outcomes, and better cost. Yes, in a private, controlled environment.
Last question.
I'd like to talk about Congress, if you don't mind.
Oh, absolutely.
In 2006 and 2007, we put together a bipartisan coalition representing over 7 million Americans. And we asked Congress to simply put basic privacy protections in place. Not complicated, but basic privacy protections. Starting with, you have a right to health information privacy. Very simple. Asking for the right to segment sensitive information, you should have that right. You should have the right to opt into systems. You should be notified of breaches. There should be meaningful recourse when your privacy is violated. We asked for basic protections, and we had Christian Coalition, Family Research Council, all the way over to the ACLU. We had numerous consumer organizations and privacy organizations, including EPIC. We had the California Medical Association. And last year in 2007, a number of technology vendors signed on with consumers across the nation asking for these basic protections. Nothing fancy, just what we've always had, and that's why we talk about restoring our control. Microsoft was one that signed our letter, but also some smaller companies. You take control, Universata, and another one called Tolvin. But the technology industry has come to see this as smart business. Every poll that's ever been taken shows consumers want control. And the truth is, technology can deliver that. What we've got is an industry built up of massive legacy systems. And these legacy systems in the hospitals don't work well for the purposes that doctors and patients, you know, want to use medical record systems for. That's what John's talking about. You got one technology system that moves labs around, another moves x-rays around, another transfers notes. These systems were not built, you know, to deliver clinical care. And so trying to rejigger them, you know, is going to be a painful process. And the industry, guess what? Doesn't want to do that.
Yes, we do.
No, some people do. Yeah, absolutely. It, you know, the future of technology is going to be, it's going to be like in other industries. You know, corporations have to be green. To survive in technology, you're going to have to provide consumer control. That's the future. You know, it's been the law. And the one thing that I want to say about when you talk about risk, Peter, you know, nothing is risk-free. We understand the difference between security risks. Those are one thing. And you know, we believe the technologists are going to do everything they can to fix those. But the privacy risks, where millions and millions of entities can use your data, that's not acceptable. That's not a risk. That's a systemic use of information today, and that needs to be stopped. And so we know e-prescribing is coming up. We're going to say no e-prescribing unless you get to opt out of having your prescription records sold. In West Virginia, 200,000 public employees got together and they said, look, Express Scripts, we're not going to use you to deliver our medicines if you keep selling our prescriptions. So Express Scripts backed off and they said, you know what? I think we'll stay in the medication selling business. You know, so consumers can act and can, we can put the brakes on this stuff, and we are going to. You know, privacy is a killer issue. Nancy Johnson, the leader of Health IT without privacy in the House in 2006, she's not here anymore. Now, I don't know if it was over privacy issues, but there was a lot that she heard from constituents, and, you know, we had an op-ed in her paper. So this is something that regular people believe in very, very much, their right to control information. And it's a, you know, it's a winner for politicians. It's a winner. Who wouldn't want to get votes from across the aisle for standing up for privacy? Every segment of the population wants this, and it's the only sane way to build a system. And I guess I'm allowed to say sane because I'm a shrink.
Maybe. Thank you all very much. Does somebody want to respond back to that? Or are we... Legia looks...
I just have a comment that I have okay. to put out there. I think I want to underscore the point that Peter was making, and there are echoes across the table about this, about considering privacy within the broader context of all the other value that we're potentially going to get from HIT. And I think that one of the things that's essential to having real success of health information sharing is consumer trust. Consumer trust depends upon a number of things. Sound technology, sound policies, but I also think we have to be very careful not to go out there and undermine that trust.
The only way you get it is if they believe you're going to do exactly what you say you will with their information. That's my practice. That's what I've been hearing for 30 years. People have to trust you. The only reason they come in the door is if they believe you're going to do what they want and not hurt them.
Well, on that note, thank you very much. Thank the panel.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.